This is Progressive Radio, a weekly conversation hosted by Matthew Rothschild, editor of The Progressive Magazine, a leading voice for peace and social justice. For more information about Progressive Radio or The Progressive Magazine, log on to our website at progressive.org.
I'm Matt Rothschild, and welcome to Progressive Radio, which you can also download off our website over at progressive.org. My guest this week is Senator Tom Harkin of Iowa, one of the leading liberals, a fighting liberal in the U.S. Senate. He's now the new chairman of the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee at the Senate, which Ted Kennedy used to chair. Senator Harkin, welcome to Progressive Radio.
Well, Matt, it's good to be with you.
Hey, some reflections maybe at the beginning on Ted Kennedy, whose chairmanship you're taking over.
Well, gosh, a lot of reflections. I spoke on the Senate floor about him. We gave our eulogies. I guess reflections. I served on his committee for 22 years. He first asked me to come on his committee in 1987. I'd only been in the Senate 2 years, and when I came, it was controlled by Republicans, and then the Democrats took it back in the election of 86, and he wanted me on his committee, and I sort of kind of demurred a little bit, and I didn't know him, played a little hard to get. And so I told him, I said, well, at the time, I said, you know, I'm really interested in disability policy. He knew that. He knew that I'd done some work in the House on deafness and other disability issues. And I told him I was really interested in that, and could he carve out something for me on that? And by gosh, he came back, and he said, well, we'll make this disability policy subcommittee, and you can chair it. And that was just really generous of him. And then when we did the Americans with Disabilities Act, he could have taken that for his own. I mean, he'd done a lot of work on disability issues too. But he knew how much I cared about it, my passion for it, and he let me put my name on it. He let me manage the bill, and the rest, as they say, is history. But I just always thought that was a wonderful act of generosity on his part. He was always willing to let other people do these kinds of things. And, of course, he had a great sense of humor too, as you probably know. And I told the story once about how he and I were on a phone call, and it was right around St. Patrick's Day, and it got heated because we were disagreeing on something. I mean, it really got heated to the point where I was kind of holding the phone out from my ear, and he was yelling at me, and I was yelling at him, and I had a couple of staff people in my office, and finally we got to the point we just both hung up on each other. My staff, they were just, they thought, oh my gosh, this great relationship between Harkin and Kennedy, it's all gone. So a few hours after that, I went to the Senate floor, and Kennedy was sitting at his desk. So I went up to him. I pulled up a chair, and I said, hey, Ted, I said, gosh, I'm really sorry about, you know, losing my temper. And, you know, oh, yeah. He said, look, I said, my staff is really worried about this, about our relationship. He got that kind of twinkle in his eye, and I kind of chuckled a little bit. And he said, well, he said, my staff was worried too. And he said, I just told him, that's the way two Irishmen celebrate St. Patrick's Day.
How'd you get interested in disability issues?
Well, my brother was disabled. I had a brother I grew up with who was deaf from a very early age. And I just saw how he was treated. You know, he was sent away to the Iowa School for the Deaf and was not treated very well there. When he went there, a young boy, then when he graduated from high school there, he was told he could do three things. He could be a shoe cobbler, a baker, or a printer's assistant. And he told him he didn't want to do any of those things. So they said, okay, you're going to be a baker. And so it was like, you know, because he was deaf, he couldn't plan his own life. He couldn't do things. And then when he went to get a driver's license and how hard that was, and I just saw how he'd been treated. And so I said, God, if I ever got in a position to do something about that, I would. And fortunately, I did and was able to do something about it.
And you also learned to speak sign language.
Oh, I learned sign language very well when I was growing up. From my brother, and have done a lot of signing. In fact, when the Americans with Disabilities Act passed the Senate, I gave my speech in sign language. The only time in the Senate where you didn't hear anyone, hear anyone, Matt. I remember Senator Bob Kerry was sitting in the chair at the time, and to this day he always says, "I'll never forget." He said, "I'm sitting up there, and I called on you, and all of a sudden I couldn't hear anything. All of a sudden, I saw your fingers and hands waving." And he said, I didn't know what you were doing. He said, I didn't know if you were having some kind of a stroke or what was going on. And all of a sudden, he figured out I was using sign language.
I read on the web in preparation for this interview a deaf person who saw you either that time or at another time signing, doing sign language of a speech, and the guy said he thought he'd died and gone to heaven because he'd never been to a public event where an elected official had given a speech and signed. So,
that's nice.
I mean, you never know the effect you have on people, but I imagine you've had a lot of effect on people with the ADA bill.
Well, that was a wonderful piece of legislation, the Americans with Disabilities Act. You know, one of the nice things of being around as long as I've been, aside from getting seniority, Matt, is, of course, and doing good progressive things, is you can see what's happened, some of the things you did in the past. So we got the Americans with Disabilities Act passed in 1990. So 19 years later, a lot of changes. I mean, we take a lot of things for granted now. We take for granted that you have curb cuts all over. We take for granted that elevators are accessible, that every building being built in America now, since that time, every new building is fully accessible. Our transit systems are available, are accessible. In fact, just the other day, I got on a plane, and a person got on the seeing eye dog on an airplane. And that they didn't used to allow that. So, and then you see families going to restaurants and eating together with someone who's disabled, and there's no problems there any longer. So accessibility has really increased. You see a lot more. We mandated in the bill, as you know, that employers had to provide reasonable accommodations for people with disabilities. So more and more people with disabilities are seeking jobs, going to school, learning, and then seeking jobs out there. So it's nice to see all that happening.
And that's a weird thing about social change. Once it happens, it becomes kind of part of the scenery and fades in, and people think it was always there. And it's like minimum wage laws or laws against child labor. I mean, these things, you know, progressive fought for back in the day, and now people just accept it as it's what any decent society would have.
Exactly.
Now, tell me what role you're going to have here as chair of this Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee in this big healthcare debate we're having right now.
Well, it is. As you might imagine, it's a great honor for me to take over the Kennedy Committee. But I'm up to it. I believe and as I said at the time when I took it over, I said I intend to carry out his legacy. And first and foremost is to get a health care bill passed. That was the cause of his life. He called me up after the last election, last November, and said, we're going to do this. We're going to get this health care now with Obama elected. We're going to get this. And he said, I know how much you care about wellness and prevention. So he asked me to do that part of the bill. And this was Kennedy again. He asked me to do that part of the bill. He asked Barbara Mikulski, Senator Mikulski, to do the quality assurance. Jeff Bingaman to do the coverage. Patty Murray, Senator Murray from Washington, to do the workforce development. So we all had parts of it. And so we all developed this bill, and we got it through the HELP committee. And now get this thing through and get it to the president, hopefully before Thanksgiving. So my role as the chairman is going to be to continue to push this, get the time on the floor, and to get a good progressive bill through, one that has a good, strong public option in it for everyone.
I mean, you're on record as saying that's going to be part of the bill. I mean, how confident are you? Because when I've been listening to some of the noises coming out of the Obama administration, it sounds to me like they've been, you know, backing away from that.
Well, I think there was probably some debate within the ranks, but, you know, just recently, as you know, he spoke to Congress and made it very clear he was for a public option. Now, he used one phrase in there that I think a lot of my liberal friends have misinterpreted. He said in that speech, he said, you know, he kind of looked at the Republicans. He said, now, just keep in mind, this is just one part of the bill. This is just one part.
Yeah, that's what got me a little worried.
Well, now let me explain that for you. Because I haven't talked to Obama, but I talked to his people around him. Here's really what he's saying. Look, that's one part of the bill. Now, maybe you disagree with that. But are you going to vote against all these other things we're doing? You know, Matt, a lot of times we pass legislation into Congress. Now, I have been chairman of the Ag Committee, as you know, and we put through a farm bill last time. 2 years ago, I think a pretty darn good farm bill, but there were a lot of things in it I didn't like, even as chairman. But there were a lot of other things I did like. So that's, you know, we don't always have the perfect. So you have to sometimes take the bad with the good. So I think what Obama was saying is, look, that's one part of the bill. Now, Matt, there's a lot of people saying, well, you know, if we have a public option, it won't get the number of votes. Well, we don't know because we haven't voted on it yet. But you tell me, we put a bill out there that has no pre-existing conditions, that company can't deny you that. They can't jack up your rates if you get sick. No lifetime caps. Your kids are covered till they're age 26. No deductibles, no co-pays for physical checkups and mammograms and colonoscopies. Got all that stuff in it. And it has a public option. You mean to say someone's going to vote against all that just because they don't like the public option? See, what they can say is, look, I don't like the public option, but all the rest of this stuff is pretty darn good.
But maybe they'll do the reverse with the liberals and say, you know, you're going to vote all against all that after we've taken the public option out, even though there's all that good stuff in there, then what are the liberals?
No, we're not taking the public option out. No, it's our bill.
No, I know, but that may be a strategy of some of the Democrats who are less liberal and maybe even part of the Obama strategy.
Well, it's not my strategy, and I can tell you I'm chairman, and Chris Dodd is also going to be helping on and getting this bill through. We will have a public option in that bill. Now, I can't tell you that it's going to win, but I can tell you it's going to be in the bill that we put on the Senate floor, and people are going to have to vote on it.
Senator Harkin, explain what the problem would be if there isn't a public option. Why is public option so important?
Well, why it's so important is that if you don't have that, then there's no real check on the insurance companies and what they can charge and what their coverage is, what their deductibles are, and the profits they make. I mean, you know, the health insurance industry, you know, we've been through a big recession. I think they've been making record profits in the last couple of years while we're in the depths of a recession. Well, I don't need to go through all the horror stories. You know those as well as I do, and so do your listeners. But a public option is one, like we put in our bill, it is available to anyone in the nation and all our territories. Doesn't make any difference what your pre-existing condition is or who you are or how old you are or whether you have a job or not. And if you get that public option, you can take it wherever you go. Go from one state to the next or wherever you want to go, you can keep that with you. Third, it will be the rates and stuff will be set by the Secretary of Health and Human Services. Coverage and rates will be set by the Secretary of Health and Human Services. That means we don't have to worry about profit margins. We don't have to worry about big buildings. We don't have to worry about corporate jets. We don't have to worry about CEOs that are paid $5 million a year. You know, so that kind of puts a good check on what the insurance companies can do.
I'm speaking with Tom Harkin. Of course, he's the senator from Iowa who's newly the chair of the Health, Education, Labor, and Pensions Committee in the Senate. I'm Matt Rothschild. I'm the editor at the Progressive Magazine, and this is Progressive Radio. Senator Harkin, tell me what you make of this teabag phenomenon, these teabaggers at the town hall meetings. I just saw a video on the web of one of your town hall meetings, and there were some teabagger right-wing people there. How do you deal with that? Where are they coming from? What do you make of it?
Well, I had practice, Matt. You know, I was in the House of Representatives before. I represented the most conservative Republican district of Iowa. And at that time in the 70s, when I came in, 74 through 84, in my district was the Iowa home of the John Birch Society. Now, a lot of young people, they don't even know what the John Birch Society is. But they were there, and they used to come and try to disrupt my meetings and stuff. So I've had a little practice with them. Now, watching these teabaggers come back kind of reminds me of the Birchers. I thought, oh, my God, here they come again. It's that same kind of know-nothing reaction. It's based a lot on fear, and that fear is stoked by people like Beck, Glenn Beck and Rush Limbaugh and people like that that stoked those fears. And I might say some other Republican senators and others that are out there saying, you know, you have every right to be afraid that they're going to pull the plug on grandma and stuff like that, which they know is absolutely false. And so people get disturbed. They get upset. But I got to tell you, in almost every one of my town meetings, there's always one or two people that want to disrupt everything. Out of 150 people, you got 30 or 40 maybe that are kind of upset. They've heard bad things, but you only got three or four that really want to disrupt everything. And on more than one occasion, I've called on one of those disruptors, and they get all wrapped up. They start on health care, and then they come up with the horror stories. Then pretty soon they drift into the Federal Reserve System, they drift into the gold standard and the Trilateral Commission, and they're just all wound around the axle, you know? And it's the same old right-wing kind of stuff. So it's not just health care. It's just kind of a right-wing, nutty agenda.
Speaking with Senator Harkin, you alluded to some senators who were stoking some of this. One of them is your co-senator from Iowa, Senator Grassley, who said outrageous things about these death panels. Why did he do that, and what kind of relationship do you have with him after he does something like that?
Well, I've had a pretty decent relationship with Senator Grassley, and when he said that, I said that, you know, he shouldn't. I was quoted in the paper saying, you know, he shouldn't say that because he knows it's not so. And he really got taken to task by editorial writers in Iowa, newspapers across the state, not all liberal, just, you know, Main Street newspapers and stuff, said he just shouldn't be saying things like that because that's just not so. What's interesting is that in our bill, that provision in our bill about, you know, what they're talking about pulling the plug on grandma, which only is that Medicare, we say that Medicare can reimburse doctors if they voluntarily consult with the family members about end-of-life matters and that type of thing. That was put in by a Republican, Senator Isaacson from Georgia. And so, you know, so Senator Grassley's going on about it, and Senator Isaacson is a pretty conservative Republican. And he came out and said, this is just nuts what these right-wingers are saying. So I just think Senator Grassley, I think a lot of times these Republicans, they go to these meetings and they get these wing nuts there and these right-wingers, and you kind of cave into them a little bit and pander to them a little bit, and you shouldn't do it.
I'm worried about the hostility there is toward Obama out in the country, but also in Congress. I mean, we talked about Grassley. There was this Representative Joe Wilson who screamed out in the middle of the recent speech by Obama and called him a liar or said, you lie. I mean, and if a Democratic representative had done that when George W. Bush was speaking, I can only imagine what would happen to him. What would have happened to that person?
Oh, I'm sure the Republicans would have had a motion of censure. They would have done something like that.
Is that going to happen in this instance?
No, I don't think so. Yeah, one of the things I've always enjoyed about being a progressive, a liberal, is that we fight. Don't get me wrong. I know how to fight, Matt. Okay? I don't hold the record for defeating more sitting Republican members of Congress than anyone in U.S. history for nothing. So I know how to fight. But There's a way of fighting and not having that hard, sharp edge and making it personal like a lot of these right-wingers do. It's a hard, sharp, personal. It goes to your character, to who you are and what you are. And that all started under Newt Gingrich and all that when they came up with all these words, how to describe your opponent as sick and sick liberal and wacko, all that kind of stuff to – it wasn't what you believed and stuff. It was kind of who you were as a person. And I've always tried to avoid that. I go after their thoughts. I go after what they stand for. But not that sharp edge in going after them as a person.
Do you ever worry, Senator Harkin, with the ugliness that has been expressed recently, worry for Obama's safety?
Well, I am, of course. But, boy, I can tell you, I've been around Obama lately, and when he's moved and done different things – The amount of protection that they've done is more than I've ever seen for any president.
I mean, I saw that the death threats were up threefold or fourfold from Bush's time.
Yeah, and what's really bad is a lot of these right wing radio people and stuff, they stoke that all the time. They stoke those fears and people who have, you know, maybe if they have some paranoia at all or something like that or some mental problems, boy, that can be explosive.
I want to talk about another issue, Senator Harkin, and that is this question of accountability for the terrible torture and abuse of detainees that occurred under the Bush-Cheney administration. To my mind, it was something that flowed completely naturally from George W. Bush saying the Geneva Conventions don't apply and from Donald Rumsfeld giving a list of abusive techniques, to put it euphemistically, that you can use on detainees. You've been concerned about human rights issues since Indonesia invaded East Timor in 1975 and from the tiger cages back in Vietnam in 1969-1970. It seems to me we need accountability for what happened and how are we going to get that?
You know, Matt, when you mentioned that, when this Abu Ghraib thing broke out and all the information came out, I thought, oh, my God, I thought we'd done away with that with the tiger cages. And, you know, it was Progressive Magazine that that really blew the lid off this thing. Thank you very much in, for doing that at the time and publishing.
Well, why don't you explain that. how you were an aide to a congressman.
I was an aide to a congressman.
But you were on a visit to Vietnam, and explain how you stumbled on these tiger cases.
Well, it was one of those trumped-up kind of visits under the Nixon administration. It was led by a hawk, Sonny Montgomery from Mississippi. I happened to be picked as an aide to go along with it by a congressman from Iowa. I really naively at that time thought that they really wanted to get all sides of the equation and wanted to hear all the views, and so I found this young man by the name of Don Luce who had written a book called Vietnam, The Unheard Voices. I read it. I thought, this is a different perspective on it. And so I got Luce in to speak to them, but then I found out they really weren't interested in that. And then Luce introduced me to a young man who had been in the tiger cages. He'd been a student leader, and they let him out, but they kept his brother there. And they said, if you ever say anything, we're going to kill him. But Luce brought him to me, and he put his trust in me, and he drew me a map on how to find him. And so with that, we were able to find these tiger cages and expose what was going on. And it wasn't just the Vietnamese. It was our own government doing this, our own government working with the Vietnamese to put these civilians in these tiger cages, along with some North Vietnamese prisoners, in clear violation of the Geneva Convention. And here we'd been saying all along, we want the North Vietnamese to abide by the Geneva Convention. Heck, we weren't doing it ourselves. Well, anyway, that's just a little bit of that background, and Progressive published that story. That was in 1970. But look, you got to have accountability. And you know, what makes me so mad about Abu Ghraib and people like that, it's always the grunts. Now, I agree, they ought to be disciplined too. Now, people that do these things ought to be disciplined. But the people up above that give the orders or close their eyes or give a nod or who put these things in play, they ought to be held accountable to it. And I don't care where it leads to. And if it leads to Mr. Cheney, so be it. So be it.
I mean, Obama said neither the grunts nor the people who were, you know, in the Justice Department anyway, leaving aside Rumsfeld and Cheney and Bush, neither the grunts nor the Justice Department lawyers were going to be going after.
Well, that's not what Eric Holder's saying. So now the Attorney General.
Well, except he's saying he's going to go after people who went outside the guidelines. Isn't that all? The person who brought the power drill or the handgun in to the interrogation session he's going to go after. I don't think he's going to go after the lawyers who were writing the memos.
Well, they should be gone after. How do you clean it? I mean, then if we don't do that, then it just another president who comes in who faces that says, well, they didn't do anything to them, so we can do the same thing. And we're right back in that cesspool where we were before. Now, I don't mean to do it any any kind of retribution or something, but I think that we following orders is not an excuse. I thought we settled that issue at Nuremberg. We settled that issue. It is not enough to follow orders, and especially for officers. You know, when I was an officer in the military, we took an oath. The oath was to uphold and defend the Constitution against all enemies, foreign and domestic. That's the oath we took. The oath that enlisted people take is that, but to obey all lawful orders of those people above them. All lawful orders. Now, an officer doesn't take, I don't take that. Officers don't take that. We only take an oath to uphold and defend because more is expected of an officer that you're going to be responsible. And so that's why, on the one hand, you go after them. Were these orders lawful? If they were lawful, then the men under them, well, still, then you can't really go after them. But these orders were not lawful. The orders to do this kind of abuse of prisoners and this torture were not lawful orders. Therefore, the grunts, the people at the bottom, ought to be punished to send a signal to others. You don't have to obey those kinds of orders. And then you've got to go after the officers and the people up the chain of command.
Because I was looking at this, the war crime statute that's on our books, in conspiracy to commit torture as a war crime. And it seems to me what Cheney and Rumsfeld and Addington and Gonzalez, those people were conspiring to commit torture.
No doubt about it. No doubt about it. And that's why we can't just sweep this under the rug. It just can't be. And there's a number of us who are continuing to prod the Justice Department and others to keep on this. It may take some years. That's all right. They got to know that we're going after them, and we're going to get the truth out, and we're going to get it out so people know exactly who said what, who did it, who put this in play.
Senator Harkin, one of the things that concerns me about the Obama administration is its decision to continue this policy of renditions, which is a terrible euphemism, too. You kidnap someone, you send them to a foreign country, and you kind of outsource the interrogation. And usually, at least in the Bush administration, was with a wink and a nod to the torturers. Yeah. And so why do you think Obama's doing that, and what can we do to stop that?
Well, I don't know. I'm as disturbed as you are by this. This whole rendition, I never heard that word before just a few years ago. But then I did find something else. You know, these countries that these prisoners are sent to, they don't just do it out of the goodness of their heart. There's a lot of money taking place here.
How do you mean?
Well, I mean our government is paying them to do these things. Well, what the heck? Why not? You know, if they can get a lot of money, they'll do it. So rendition is not just some country saying, well, yeah, we'll take them and we'll do this.
Also, sometimes there's a CIA personnel there.
And there's no doubt about the fact that we have CIA personnel there. No doubt about that. So I think we have to. This thing just has to stop. This idea of this being able to pick up someone and send them to Egypt or some other place like that to be tortured and interrogated, where our laws don't apply, is something that we got to stop.
I mean, it's reasons like that in the Afghan war and some of the retreats on health care and the bailing out the banks that has disturbed progressives with Obama, who had higher hopes for Obama. How are you on that question? I mean, where do you think Obama's going?
Well, you know, I didn't vote for Geithner. But so you go. So I'm not very happy with that economic team he's got. And, you know, Bernanke, you know, he got just reappointed. Well, I've got mixed feelings about him. But, you know, he was aided and abetted this whole debacle that went on in New York and with all these derivatives and the swaps and the credit default swaps. I mean, he aided and abetted that whole thing. Well, some say, well, but he learned his lesson and stuff. Well, I'm not so certain about that. I'd rather much see somebody in there that warned against this a long time ago and was not a part of it. But, look, you know, we liberals, we progressives have got to keep pushing the administration. It's not the first time this has happened to me in my lifetime, but we've got to keep pushing a good progressive agenda and not let up on it, or else Obama will be pulled the other direction.
What do you see happening in 2010? Do you think the Democrats are going to lose seats there? Are you worried about that?
If we don't start getting some steel in our spine and stand for good progressive issues right now, when we have such a huge majority in the Senate and in the House, and we have a president who served with me and my committee in the Senate, for God's sakes, and he was very progressive on all these issues. Well, I think people, once you start getting wobbly in the knees, you know, then people start walking away from you. And we can't do that. We've got to have some more spine than that. And we've got to stand for good progressive causes, and the president's got to, too. That will energize our base. You know, my philosophy has always been, Matt, in tough races in Iowa, I'd rather have 40% of the people out there organizing, mobilizing, energizing, than to have 60% of the people say they kind of like me. You know, because I'll fight you for the 11%. I can fight you for that extra 11% I need. But if I got that 40% out there with me, I don't have any fear. And that's what we got to do with our base in America. We got to solidify that base. And that's labor unions, it's progressives, and it's getting us under that whole banner of a progressive agenda in this country.
And you think if we do that, Obama's knees won't be so wobbly?
I sure hope not. Yeah. It's like old Franklin Roosevelt once said one time. He said, paraphrasing, he said, I know that we got to do this. Now, you guys, you go out there and make me do it. Well, we'll make Obama do it.
Well, that's our task. And unfortunately, we're out of time right now. But Tom Harkin, I want to thank you so much for being my guest today.
Matt, thank you, and thanks for all you do with The Progressive.
Oh, you're quite welcome.
Today's program is available online at progressive.org. You can also write to us at 409 East Main Street, Madison, Wisconsin, 53703. Our music is by Mufa. Progressive Radio is produced by Elizabeth DiNovella and engineered at Audio for the Arts in Madison, Wisconsin.